Coming up, it's philosophy talk.
Look, guys, the punishment for resisting arrest shouldn't be death. The punishment for selling bootleg CDs shouldn't be death. The punishment for being a black man shouldn't be death.
Hasn't America always denied that Black Lives Matter?
We are following that path to collective liberation by deeply, deeply focusing on the group that historically in this country has been the most oppressed.
Isn't anyone who denies that race matters simply blind?
Framing an issue as simply a racial issue contributes to the kind of tribalism that gets us the conservative backlash.
How does it follow from the fact that black lives matter that other lives don't?
Where's the outrage, guys? I thought all lives mattered to you.
What is the philosophy behind the Black Lives Matter movement?
Our guest is Christopher LeBron, author of The Making of Black Lives Matter, A Brief History of an Idea.
Race matters. Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Do black lives really matter in America?
Have they ever mattered in our sordid racial history?
What can we do to make sure black lives matter today?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Deborah Satz, and we're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco,
continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Deborah and I teach philosophy.
Today, we're thinking about race and why it still matters.
You know, Deborah, as a black man, I have to say, I find it kind of depressing that here we are pretty deep into the 21st century, and there's still a question about whether black lives really matter.
It is depressing. But there's not only bad news. We've eliminated formal discrimination in housing. We've made progress. We've removed many of the old barriers in voting. Sure, our schools and neighborhoods may be segregated in fact, but at least they're not segregated in law.
I wouldn't deny that's all well and good, but it's not nearly enough to ease my depression, I'm afraid. I mean, think of the racial inequality in our so-called criminal justice system. Take the way cops gun down young black men with impunity. Or the fact that we stuff black and brown bodies into our prisons till they're filled to the rim. Did you know, Deborah, that there are more young black men in prison than in college?
This is a moral disaster. Our prison system is a moral disaster. But it's not only a disaster for black people, it's a disaster for white people, too. And if you want white people on board with fixing racially problematic institutions, like our broken criminal justice system, you've got to show them that it's their problem, too. It's not just a problem for black people.
Are you saying that instead of saying black lives matter, we have to say all lives matter? Because, you know, whites are just so tired. They're so tired of dealing with black grievance. And then black people have to kowtow to white sensibilities just to get a little racial justice.
Wait a second. Who's talking about black people kowtowing? I'm talking about getting all people, black, white, brown, to recognize our common problems. We're all in this together.
Yeah, I don't know, Deborah. Sounds like you're demanding colorblind solutions to problems that are so deeply colored by race. And, you know, that's never worked in the past. I don't think it can work now.
Focusing on common problems doesn't mean being colorblind. Besides, it's the only way forward. Look, I grant that the criminal justice system disproportionately affects the lives of black people. I'm even willing to grant that it was explicitly designed to work that way.
Now you're talking, Deborah. Yeah, but what are you going to do about it?
Replace it, root and branch, with something more just, more equitable, and more effective. And not just for black people, for all people. And once we do that, you know what's going to happen? Black people will disproportionately benefit, since they're disproportionately harmed by the current system.
Look, I get your strategy. You want to do an end run around our racial divisions. You want to focus on what unites us and not what divides us.
Yes.
Yeah, but you know, Deborah, if we go that route, I think we run the risk of ignoring the urgent problems that black people face. And history has proven over and over again that America needs a constant reminder that black lives matter.
I agree. But history also teaches us that when we frame our problems in racial terms, we end up pitting one racial group against another. And when that happens, we all lose.
But saying black lives matter isn't pitting one group against the other. It's not saying that other lives don't matter. It's not about excluding others. It's about finally including black people in the collective we. You know, I think what we really need, we need a way to combine two things. A passionate plea for racial justice with a full-throated acknowledgement of the importance of justice for all. That's what we need.
I agree. But my point is that given how racially divided Americans are, emphasizing race is a risky strategy.
No, I can't deny that given our history. But avoiding race is a risky strategy too because, let's face it, black people don't hear themselves included in an insincere All Lives Matter.
So can the Black Lives Matter movement be the vanguard of a social justice movement for all, or is it just for black people?
To answer that question, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to take a closer look at Black Lives Matter. She files this report.
In September, a St. Louis police officer charged with murdering a man named Anthony Lamar Smith was acquitted. Protests broke out, and they've continued every single night for the last 5 weeks.
My people tired of this. So whatever happened, I just pray for my city.
It's likely that the story of the verdict and the protests didn't even penetrate your news cycle. From the sound of the media, it might seem like the entire Black Lives Matter movement is over. It was an outcry of pain with hard-to-trace results. But that's not how St. Louis organizer Kayla Harris sees it.
In 3 years, my life has completely changed.
When Michael Brown was killed in 2014, a local movement was born in the St. Louis-Ferguson area. Harris became politicized.
I was going to protest every day and I was working two jobs.
And now she organizes full time to change the systems that create police abuse.
What we have been fighting is divestment from the institution of policing. We've been pushing against systems like cash bail
and predatory fines and building an electoral strategy.
And right now what we're fighting, there is a proposition on the ballot this November that seeks to give the police $20 million more dollars. So we're actively fighting that.
These local campaigns, even when they win, don't always command our attention. What has easily dominated the news lately is the All Lives Matter backlash and the alt-right. White supremacists aren't the only ones to critique Black Lives Matter. There are critiques from sympathizers, too.
Hashtag Black Lives Matter succinctly summed up the visceral frustrations that so many black and brown people felt, myself included.
Torre Reed writes about politics and he teaches African American history. He supports the fight against the prison and policing industrial complexes, but he worries
framing an issue that impacts, albeit black people and Latinos disproportionately, but quite a few whites as well, as simply a matter of black lives, as simply a racial issue, I think, you know, contributes to the kind of tribalism that gets us the conservative backlash or Trumpism.
Reed doesn't blame Black Lives Matter for the existence of white racism, but he's skeptical of the movement's ability to end it without working on the class systems that keep us segregated, physically, professionally, culturally.
I mean, I grew up in Southwest Atlanta and New Haven, Connecticut, and I didn't have any white peers before I moved to New Haven, Connecticut. I heard a lot of crazy things about white people, and thus I believed a lot of crazy things about white people. I had had these unexamined prejudices that had festered in isolation.
Reed worries that a movement for and by black lives just won't be inclusive and big enough to change the conditions that divide us. He says Black Lives Matter is morally right.
But frankly, in a democracy, 13% can't win. So there's nothing lost by pointing to the fact that whites are the majority of people who are murdered by police officers. And it makes sense then to strike alliances with poor and working class whites and Latinos.
In the local campaigns that Kayla Harris fights for, she knows her wins will also benefit poor people who are not Black.
The class portion of the conversation often includes non-Black people, and that's okay.
Her campaigns are not all strictly racial justice issues.
We are following that path to collective liberation by deeply focusing on the group that historically in this country has been the most oppressed.
Maybe leading with a racial message alienates some people from the cause. But Harris says for her, it's the whole reason she shows up. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks, Liza, for that really thought-provoking and deep, moving report. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Deborah Satz. And today, we're thinking about how race matters.
We're joined now by Christopher LeBron. Chris is professor of philosophy at Johns Hopkins University, and recently he's the author of The Making of Black Lives Matter, A Brief History of an Idea. Chris, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Deborah and Ken, thank you very much for having me on.
So, Chris, I know as a political scientist, I think you haven't always worked on race issues.
What did you just call me?
A political scientist and philosopher. You haven't always worked on race issues, right? And what changed to get you focused on these things?
So, in a manner of speaking, I hadn't always worked on race, but it's been a long time since that wasn't the case. So when I first got to grad school, I was determined to not be, well, I should give some background, given the low diversity in top graduate programs. I got my PhD from MIT. Going into grad school, I was determined to not be that guy, you know, the brown, Black guy who, of course, he's brown or Black, he's going to study race.
Right.
And so my initial research agenda was to do something with the philosopher John Rawls and global justice. At the time, I was very preoccupied by the idea of war and how we go about justify killing people. I thought John Rawls could help me out with that, but it didn't last long. It was actually the absence of diversity, both in the classrooms at the institutions, but also on syllabi, and counted as being part of the canon. That really got me going to thinking I need to actually be working on race, because there just wasn't enough of it in my view. Not that there wasn't any, of course, there were people working on it, but compared to the flood of liberal theorists working on some page of John Rawls's Theory of Justice or Law of Peoples or some such, wasn't enough work. And I had to also figure some stuff out for myself. I felt deeply alienated, very alone, and really quite frustrated by the fact that I was reading these works that were considered great works in political philosophy, and of course, to a certain degree, they are great works. I can't deny the rigor, but there's a certain kind of failure of imagination and kind of sociological capacity.
Right. So we got it. We got it.
So, yeah. Chris, I want to hearken back to something Ken said in our intro. He said that Black people don't hear themselves in All Lives Matter. So, is that true? Like, and what is that? What's that about?
So no, we don't hear ourselves, because it's a disingenuous counter retort to the idea that Black lives matter. And we don't hear ourselves, I don't think, because part of it seems to be an obfuscation of the deeper ethical claim, not to prioritize or make Black lives superior, but to just bring them to an equal playing field. And it's turned out that in America, even asking that much just for equal consideration seems to be a great source of difficulty for many Americans.
But suppose I was a liberal-minded, progressive person, and I sincerely mean that all lives matter, and I want to see to it that all lives matter, right? I mean, I think there are some people who think that way, and I think the white lives matter people, they're just denying Black lives matter, but the people who think of themselves as liberal progressives who assert, yes, you too, all lives do matter. Is there something wrong with that? Is there something they're missing?
Well, it only depends on when it's being said, right? So as an ethic, people who say Black lives matter also believe that all lives matter, and they can actually say all lives matter quite consistently. It's a matter of when those three words are said in the conversation. So if a Black man, Black woman has been shot in the street, and we say, see, that's why Black lives matter, and this liberal progressive says, it's true, all lives matter, they've actually missed the point and actually introduced an unhelpful kind of locution in a moment where we're trying to figure out why is that Black body in the street I mean, no body should be in the street, but why is that black body in the street? So I'm trying to figure that out, and it's clear because it's a black body saying all lives matter actually moves us away from trying to figure out.
So you think it's highly contextual, right? It's the context and the tone and the situation in which that's offered as a retort. In a different situation, it might not be so much of a retort.
To a certain degree, sure. Let's go with that. Sure.
Okay. So we'll dig deeper into these things after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about how race matters with Chris LeBron from Johns Hopkins University.
In our next segment, we'll ask, why are we still talking about race? More than 150 years since the abolition of slavery, 70 years since the end of Jim Crow, and after a black president was elected to the White House.
Civil rights, black power, and black lives. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. Now is the time to make black lives matter, is what Lena Horne was saying in 1963. Well, what about now? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, and we're thinking about how and why race still matters. Our guest is Chris LeBron from Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of The Making of Black Lives Matter.
So, Chris, take that litany that Deborah cited as we were going to the break. You know, slavery's overcome. Jim Crow is overcome, the voting rights, a black president. Somebody could believe, I'm not saying I believe, but somebody could believe that racism is a thing of the past. We're past all that. Okay, take such a person. What would you point to convince such a person that they've got it completely wrong?
So we should be clear, there are two classes of people. There are one class of people that just will never be convinced because they simply don't care, and ideologically they're committed to the idea that blacks are somehow just inferior people, so whatever their problems are just their problems. But then there are other people who just are ignorant, and I mean that in a very strict sense. They just don't know. And that part is easily overcome to the extent that has to do with ignorance, and that is just point to any metric of well-being in this country and just point out. Statistically and empirically, that blacks just don't have as much as anybody else, whether it be jobs, whether it be income, whether it be wealth, whether it be healthcare, whether it be access to healthy food, whether it be educational resources, legal resources. You just go down the list, and across the board, blacks are just doing much less well off.
But of course, you know, Chris, you know this. There's a narrative in this country that says if people are doing worse off than others, it's their own fault.
Right.
And you've got, you know, so how do we, you know, deal with the person who's ignorant, you know, but who's goes to the most handy explanation, the simplest explanation possible, which is people have different outcomes in life because of the different choices they make and they're responsible. That's the kind of American, you know, we're very quick to blame and right. praise and blame for things that happen to people in life. So how do you get somebody committed to that kind of worldview? You know, how do you push them off that?
So, you know, to the extent that's really a matter of just ignorance, just not knowing, you ask that person a very basic question. Do you think it could possibly be the case that a whole demographic is just inferior, less capable, more bestial, more violent? Do they really believe that? And then they have to really check themselves and figure out what they think about their co-participants in democratic scheme, and they might actually realize, hey, I'm really racist. I really think black people just are inferior people. But the person who's ignorant but isn't committed to that kind of repugnant view has to kind of see that it's actually really difficult for a whole class of people to be doing just systematically worse off in every way, shape, or form.
Well,
it's just not something that follows.
Okay, I'm going to come at you from another angle. Again, I'm trying to I'm playing a little bit of devil's advocate here, but Deborah gave you a kind of simple-minded person in a way, right, who has a simple narrative of human well-being and not well-being and all that. I'm going to give you a person with a more complicated worldview. Yes, there are many factors. There's race, there's class, there's gender, there's urban, there's rural, there's the global economy. It's grinding Americans of all stripes down. Given where we started, here's the thing that isn't. There isn't the government and its coercive power as in slavery, holding black people in chains. There isn't the government and its coercive power holding black people in Jim Crow and segregated housing and all that sort of stuff. Yes, there is a loss of jobs. There's an urban decay and all that. And part of this is that's grinding down everybody because black people started down, right, relative to these forces. When these forces were allowed to grind us down, they ground down black people more than white people. But it's not racism, it's all these other causes that we're letting our racial division blind us to. So racism is a factor, is one factor among others, a diminishingly significant factor, and we should focus on the deep factors that are the root cause of all this thing. What do you think of that, say to that person?
I'd have to hear more about the so-called deep factors, but I would probably let that person know that if they want to really dig deep down enough, at the bottom what they're probably going to find is race. So, you know,
not
work
class,
that's been done.
Not class?
I'm sure class does play a role. We definitely have issues with poverty that have to do with class in this country. But what I often find is that when we want to talk about race and the distinctive aspects and distinctive features of racial inequality, people say, but it's really about class. What it's actually really a move to do is actually just move away from the race question and actually in some senses bring the grievances back to poor white people. And poor white people have legitimate grievances, but their grievances are not the only grievances. They don't have to be afraid, as black people do, whether well off or rich, for just walking down the street while breathing. It's a remarkable thing to just be in a skin and feel endangered. And that has nothing to do with class.
Well, so I guess one question would be, you know, the question that Ken and I were debating, you know, by taking these stylized positions is, right, to what extent do you make progress on the real issues black people face by focusing on them in racial terms versus trying to focus on them in other terms? So, for example, integration, huge issue, but black poverty, huge issue. But, you know, maybe the way to deal with that is to go for universal entitlement programs, housing, you know, vouchers that people can use and low-cost housing in various kinds of, you know, in neighborhoods, better schools for everyone, and so forth.
All right. On my view, and, you know, there people disagree with this view, but this is my view. This country can't be redeemed until we face our ethical commitments. And what those kind of programs do, they may have certain effective benefits for black folks. And I can see quite easily why people would want to try and pursue those. But I've argued in previous work of my own that the problem of race in this country is a matter of social value, that black folks are simply seen as worth less. And so you can have all these programs that somehow dole out the public goodies on a more equitable basis, right? But we've also known that whenever we have laws that are passed that are supposed to benefit black folks, when we've taken formal measures, the problem of social value winds up finding its way back into those policies, and somehow black folks find themselves edged out to the margins of those benefits. So I'm actually very suspicious about any move that doesn't just try once and for all get us to just grapple with the very idea that racially we're a corrupt nation. We have very little sense of the sin we commit in devaluing certain lives just because of the more pigment in their skin. Until that happens, you can have as many programs that get around that by trying to dole out goods, and some of those may work and many people will benefit. But over the long term, black folks will always be more endangered than everybody else until we figure out, are they human or are they not? Do they count or do they not?
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about why race still matters with Chris LeBron, and we have Anthony from Berkeley on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anthony.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, what's your comment or question? Shoot.
This has been very interesting. Let's see you guys go back and forth. A lot of information and different perspectives, I should say. Me, I'm fortunate right now, if that's the word you want to use, actually living a live social experiment. I'm born and raised in L.A. I moved here to Berkeley. With the police academy, I was with the police department for 6 years until I got my college degree. I left and moved out here. Right now, I just recently purchased a cafe in the Bay Area, and I'm working to get it open. In the meantime, I'm working a very lucrative job in Silicon Valley. And by my appearance, you would never know this. I'm just simply a young-looking black man. And so on a daily basis, I experience, I guess what you would say, programming, programmed racism at every point, every juncture, whether I'm working on a cafe to get open, whether I'm at this global billion-dollar silicone entity, and it's just the most amazing thing to see. And now I will say that the majority of the, whatever you want to call it, the hate or you know, anti-programming, it comes from the younger people, and that just breaks my heart. I look way younger than I am, and it's just so sad to see that, you know, the way this, I don't know, what you want to call it, system, society is set up, the programming that goes forward through
Anthony,
live media. It's really bad.
Yeah, Anthony, that's a moving story, and thank you. I want to thank you for the call, and I want to give Chris a chance to respond, and then maybe Deborah and I have something to add. But Chris, what do you want to respond to Anthony? Thanks a lot, Anthony.
You know, I appreciate your story, Anthony, and it's a common experience, and it's the exact reason why the class argument is in some sense disingenuous, because to be even well off in Black in America, you're always seen as somehow not as well off or not as worthy. You know, right now I'm in a studio wearing a hoodie, and if I was walking down the street, no one would give me the benefit of the doubt that I'm a fairly well-paid university professor. I could be another corner boy for all they know, because that's just what they see. So.
Chris, I don't think it's right to say that the class argument is disingenuous. I think the class argument is strategic and tactical. I don't think people who believe, there are lots of different people, all kinds of people, all kinds of different thoughts, but I don't think people who believe that we should frame our solutions in class-based race are disingenuous. I actually think they believe that America is so racially riven, so racially divided, that if you try to have that conversation for redemption that you talked about, that it's just not going to work, because Americans aren't in a frame of mind to talk to each other.
And I also think if you don't take on the broad social justice issues, to say race matters isn't to say it's the only thing that matters. And there are a lot of people out there who are hurting. So, I mean, here's just a data point that I think is interesting. One of our colleagues at Stanford has tracked. There's now greater disparities in educational outcomes by income. So between the top quintile and the bottom quintile than there are between Blacks and whites. This is the first time that the economic disparities between how children do in school has actually outpaced the class disparities. So I just think if you don't grapple with that, the chances of having a successful movement are, you know, like non-existent.
So we ganged up on you there, and we're going to give you a chance to respond. And then there are a bunch of callers who want in.
So, I mean, I'll say this. It should be clear. I don't think that everyone who offers that argument is being disingenuous. I think some people are. But I'm going to be very honest. At this point, maybe I've moved to a more radical position. But Black folks are always being told to bundle their problems with somebody else's problems in order to get some progress going. And I think it's just an amazing thing that to be able to get just respect as a Black person, we have to say, but let's partner with the poor people. And of course, you can do that as well. There's no shame or anything wrong in doing that. But there's always this move in some sense, say, if you really want to get your respect, channel it through someone else's cause or co-join cause of somebody else just to get the respect you do in a very basic sense. And when you really think about it from that perspective, you really can't blame blah folks from saying, I don't want to have that other conversation about class inequality, et cetera. I want to have a conversation about race because I'm tired of having to have my problem transmuted through other people's problems. It's a form of white privilege in a certain regard.
So we have a comment from Rob, which says, should we say Black Lives Matter too, so that people can hear it? And I guess, Chris, you're actually saying, look, we don't need to explicitly say too. We're trying to make a point. We don't need to say too. We in ourselves deserve respect and we matter. And in the context of America, saying too,
I don't know. What do you think about that, Chris? I don't think the too is bad. I think the too is good. But what do you think?
I think it's unnecessary, and I think it just, in some sense, dilutes the assertiveness of those three words. They invite no compromise. when you include the two, at least when I think about this philosophically, you go, well, two, so who else matters? And then you try to do this comparative valuing of identities, and it just seems silly.
I think the two concedes to the component that you're not excluding them. You're not, I mean, yes, you're Black Lives Matter. You know, if I say Black Lives Matter too, yes, there are all kinds of lives that matter, but I want you to include these lives. So I don't think you're right. I think you're both wrong. But, you know, there are lots of callers here, and let's take a few of them. Alicia in Berkeley, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, and I really appreciate you bringing this subject up. As a woman, I know that there are many minorities who are discriminated against and have problems in culture, but I think that African Americans deserve a special kind of attention. And this, what really brought that home to me was listening to Tig Notaro's One Mississippi, an episode of that one night, and her father and her stepfather, who's, you know, sort of a typical Southern conservative, is taking this very soft-spoken Black woman out for dinner, and they're sitting under a picture of a plantation owner who is kind of being spotlighted because she was the first person in that state who paid her slaves once they became free. And the woman's comment is, yes, but she owned human beings, and those human beings are still recovering after 200 years. And I think we really need to talk about that, healing that, on top of everything else that Black people have to put up with right now.
Thanks for the call, Alicia. That's a good comment. Chris, you want to respond?
I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, if you look at the work of Joe Feagin in the literature of structural injustice, one of the things he points out is that after Reconstruction, the redistribution of land collapsed for Black folks. And if you think about one of the greatest sources of inequality in terms of assets in America, it is property ownership. And Blacks own their value of the property they own is a fraction of whites' property. But property is a very generational thing. You see it happen all the time. People have property. They take some of the wealth from that property and use it to help their kids buy their own property and so on and so forth. Property is one of those things that brings enduring and transmittable wealth. But if you don't have a starting point and you're denied that starting point, well, it takes generations for a group of people to catch up. And that has real empirical grounding in American history.
Yeah, it's Chris. This is Deborah. I think that's a really important point. And, Reconstruction was a lost opportunity in America to really, you know, eradicate the legacies of slavery. And we failed as a country to do that.
It was more than a lost opportunity. It was a wasted and squandered opportunity. But we can talk about that some more. And we waste and squander many opportunities for redemption. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about race matters with Chris LeBron, author of The Making of Black Lives Matter.
What lessons can we learn from different racial justice movements? Is Black Lives Matter in danger of becoming like the Occupy movement? Is this just a matter of 15 minutes of fame?
How to build a movement for racial justice. When Philosophy Talk continues. If those who wield power don't think Black Lives Matter too, then how do we fight the power effectively? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, and our guest is Chris LeBron from Johns Hopkins University. Chris is the author of The Making of Black Lives Matter.
And we've got a caller, Sharam, driving to SoCal. I hope you've got a hands-free device there, Sharam, but welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Yes, I do have a hands-free phone. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting conversation. I just wanted to add a brief comment. My, as a first-generation immigrant from Iran, I do want to say that this is a business-oriented society, America, and historically, Black people have been, you know, delegated to the poverty condition. So it should perhaps nowadays, because of improvement in the people's lives, you know, white people are just as likely to be poor as Black people. So maybe it should just be called Poor Lives Matter or Low Income Lives Matter.
Thanks for the call, Sharam. I think Chris isn't going to agree with you, but I'm going to give him a chance to speak for himself. What do you think, Chris?
No, I don't agree. And that's not to in any way again, I'm not against the idea of fighting for the poor. The poor, they do face real struggles. What debt collapse does is, in some sense, eliminate the distinctions of why some people are poor and why some people are not. For one group, there's a 400-year history as to why those people are poor that's steeped in murder, rape, and exploitation. If the other group, it's a different kind of story, and that story could be an important story too. But if you conflate the two, then you lose a lot of ethical urgency that comes with addressing the claims that arise from black from racial inequality.
I hear you, and I don't disagree with you. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, you do, Ken.
Yeah, no, not on a moral basis. No, I don't at all disagree with you. I mean, we have this radically imperfect union, and part of its imperfection is it was designed to enable and sustain the subjugation of black people, first through slavery, and then when it was a collective project of part of America to subjugate black people through slavery, and when the South was finally smashed, the failures of Reconstruction, the South said, we're going to re-enslave by any means necessary, and that was the collective project of white Southerners. I don't disagree with you. I agree with you profoundly, but given this country, given this divisions, given our inability to even have certain conversations, I think, well, what's the way forward, right? Moral shaming and all that. I want Americans to get to the place where they merely tolerate each other, to get them to the place where they affirm each other. I think, gosh, we got 10,000 miles to go before that. So I want to just get them to merely tolerate each other. You think that's too small?
Yeah, I do. My father wasn't a philosopher, but one of the first important philosophical lessons he learned is that he actually taught me was the problem with the word tolerate. To tolerate is to simply bear person.
Yes, right.
Yeah, but when we bear people, the criteria for ceasing to tolerate them is equally as thin. Do we really want black respect to rest on such thin foundations?
Well, build me another country, though. Build me a country in which there's mutual affirmation. How do we build that country?
And
I gotta be honest. I'm sorry, Deborah.
No,
it sounded like you wanted to
say
something.
So I just wanted to, again, get to, I absolutely agree with you that, you know, black people shouldn't make their equal dignity conditional on other people being affirmed their equal dignity. On the other hand, if we're trying to build a movement in a democracy that, brings black people into a better standing than they have in this society, you've got to get lots of people on board, and you're not going to get them on board unless you deal with the way their dignity is also ignored. I mean, that's part of the Trump phenomenon. There are many causes to it, but one was a sense of a lot of people that, like, I don't count. You know, a lot of white people, not just poor whites, of course, because Trump had a lot of support among wealthy whites, but some poor whites.
So why don't you answer that, and then I'm going to try and get another caller in here, Chris.
Sure. So I want to answer in two parts, one by referring to Dave Chappelle's skit. You know, he had this part in a recent stand-up comedy act where he says, you know, people, you know, they're not enraged by the crime. They're just upset they didn't get their cut.
Yeah, right.
And that's the way a lot of the argument from some folks about class, it seems to be that kind of a thing. You were involved in the heist. You just didn't like your cut.
Yeah.
And that's not black people's problem because we weren't the ones who committed the heist.
Right.
I just got put it just like that. But then the other part of that problem is if you ask me Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'm all about redemption. And Sundays, today I'll be about redemption. I get to choose on Sunday. So this is what I'm going to say. I want to invert the idea that blacks always have to speak about their equality in terms of other people's equality and actually speak about white folks' sense of dignity in terms of black dignity. Mm-hmm. And here you turn to somebody like Baldwin and you make the argument, look, so long as you treat me the way that you do, you're actually shortchanging your own humanity. You're an incomplete person, no matter, the car you're driving. And is that kind of art? Now, I'm not saying that is guaranteed to succeed. But if you ask me about one path forward, that's the path I want to take because I think that path, to the extent that I can succeed, is the most secure way that we can really learn to love each other.
I totally agree about if it can succeed, that would be the preferable path. I'm just more pessimistic. But we've got Susie from Berkeley here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Susie. What's your comment or question?
Thanks, Ken. I appreciate it. And to your guests' regards, I grew up here, and, when I first called up on the phone, I was all hot and bothered and angry because I'm 62, I'm Caucasian, And, you know, Berkeley is has always been considered a liberal, kind of progressive community. And my experience as a longtime native resident is that it's got the sinister veneer of progressive politics laid over as a bastion of old conservative, extremely deep conservative roots, academic roots. And I must say, I have no words for racism. It grieves me deeply, and it exists. All that old stuff is not old, it's present today. And I guess I just would like to ask you all if, I went to school with a young man by the name of Hugo Blackwell, and his father was the first African-American professor hired at UC Berkeley. And Hugo told me that when his family moved here, no one would sell a house to them. Now, that was back in the 50s or the 60s. I don't really know. Mm-hmm. Do we know anything about Professor Blackwell? He was just given posthumously the highest award a civilian could be given by President Obama a few years ago. Does anyone know?
I don't know. I'll ask Chris if he knows, but I'm also going to give him a chance to make one last comment because we're getting to the end of our time with you, Chris. So you can respond to Susie if you can help her, or you can close with one last
Susie,
comment.
I'm sorry. I don't know. I'm sorry. I can't help you with that.
So give me your closing thought here. I don't know.
So my closing thought, and I'm sorry to close this thought, but I do want to say this. We've been having a lot of conversations the past few years about the idea of white privilege, and I think that needs to now shift to a conversation about white rage. We've seen over the past 2 years a tremendous surge in this country of racial resentment that no longer fears being shamed and called out. It's not the majority of people. It's not even the majority of white people, I don't think, but it's a significant enough portion to make the rest of America turn away from the hard truths about what it means to stand up for racial egalitarianism and the violence that's being perpetrated or encouraged by our administration, by people in Las Vegas, by white supremacists in Charlottesville. And the blind eye, we turn to the rage that underlies the resentment there. I think if we don't start about white rage as a form of identity politics, I don't think we can move forward very much.
I think that's a powerful thought, and I wish we had more time, but I got to thank you now for joining us, Chris. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you very much, Ken and Deborah. I appreciate it.
Our guest has been Chris LeBron. He's a professor of philosophy at Johns Hopkins University. He's author of the very fine book, The Making of Black Lives Matter, A Brief History of an Idea. So, Deborah, what are your last thoughts here?
Well, I think Chris made a powerful case for the Black Lives Matter movement. I'm pessimistic that this movement is going to be more than Occupy, because I don't see any institutionalization of it the way the civil rights movement had the churches, the black churches involved. We are living at a time when people are so atomized and when we don't have countervailing institutions for the world that we're in, and that's a problem.
I totally agree with you, and I mean, I really agree with the moral aspects of Chris's vision, but I don't know that that's a possible America that we can get to from here. I just don't know about Americans' ability to solve this. But this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send your question to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on our blog.
Wonderful conversation today. Now, over the summer, we asked you to submit your vexing problems to our conundrum contest. Our team picked 3 finalists, and we asked you to vote for the winner. Now the results are in, so let's listen to Ken and our colleague Josh try to solve the winning conundrum from Beth.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Beth.
Thank you.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Stanford University.
I've heard of that place.
Yeah, I've heard of that place too. But what's your conundrum, Beth?
So my conundrum has been for many, many years, whether as a Peace Corps volunteer in what was once called Zaire, but today is the Democratic Republic of Congo, whether my 2 years there as a teacher in a high school really ever did any good. Before coming to Stanford, I was a foreign correspondent for the AP, and I covered some of the world's biggest stories and worst atrocities in the civil wars in West Africa and uprisings and massacres and, you know, just amazing stuff. And so I've seen my share of, you know, really vexing problems around the world, but nothing really ever vexed me more than this nagging question of whether I truly did any good in my Peace Corps village. And I always wondered whether my presence there did more harm than good by, you know, raising expectations like, oh, great, I got into college and now my life is going to be perfect.
Well, Beth,
many of the students are back in the village working as farmers because, you know, they weren't able to get any sort of a job in the big cities.
Beth, you're sounding like a person who's really hard on herself. You sound to me like you've had an amazing life and have seen the world and have contributed through the work that you did as a correspondent to our deeper understanding of the world. You sound like you've committed your life to the good. Now, the world is a complicated place. You will admit that. And no one person. I mean, there's all these tidal wave of forces impinging on Africa, all kinds of forces impinging on the African continent. And surely no one person will even be able to trace the kind of standing influence of their contributions to trying to make these forces harmonize to the good. Right? I mean, aren't you putting a really high standard on yourself?
Well, I am, but I also felt this real obligation to somehow give back to them. And like I said, there's still always that nagging question of whether I left behind more expectations than I was able to meet.
I mean, I think you raise a really interesting question, which is, so let's take one case of a person that you taught during your 2 years there.
Mm-hmm.
If you hadn't gone, I assume that person would anyway have become a farmer. I mean, it sounds like that's what you're saying. Instead, they went to college and then went into farming. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting question. Which life should we consider better? Should we consider a life, you know, life A better or life B? Life A is missing the experience of going to college and learning different kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And life B is, I suppose, missing the kind of dashed hopes and expectations. I'm not sure how to settle that question. I mean, is a life better because there weren't hopes raised that couldn't be fulfilled? Or is a life better because it's richer in certain kinds of ways? There's a diversity of experience and there's a greater and broader kinds of knowledge.
I know how to answer that question, hypothetically. Take a person who's lived both lives and see and ask them to judge. That's what Mill would say. But, of course, nobody lives two lives, so it's pretty hard to actually carry out that hypothetically. But I bet you this. I bet you those students of yours who went to college and ended up on the farm, I bet you they don't regret your involvement in their lives. I bet you they're grateful for your involvement in their lives. However it worked out after you were there, right? You touched these students in a profound way. You sound a little bit like, I don't mean this as a pejorative,
mm-hmm.
There's two kinds of people. There's moral perfectionists who think they have a duty to help perfect the world and who think they're not done doing their part until they've done all they could to mm-hmm. perfect the world. And you sound like that. And there's other people who think, well, look, I've got my part. You've got your part. The world's a big place. I, through my action, cannot possibly perfect the world. Perfecting the world is a collective, ever ongoing thing. If you lay down and don't do your part, like if broader society lays down and doesn't do its part, if the you know various corporate forces don't cooperate, if governments are corrupt, I can't change all that, but I can still do my part. Now, once I've done my part and I see the world is still a mess, should I recoil in horror? Should I say to myself, well done, well done? Should I do something in between? I mean, it's a complicated thing, but you sound like you're kind of holding yourself to a standard of, I'm not done until the world's perfected.
You know, when you leave, when you come home, the rest isn't entirely up to you. And the world has a say in that, right? And politics in Zaire or later Congo, that has a say in that. And other people have a say in that. Should you really fault yourself or the Peace Corps? Because things could have gone in a variety of different ways, right? You teach people, you give them opportunities. Isn't that kind of the limit of your responsibility, and then you just have to hope that those responsibilities will have a kind of a you know, will find a place for of application in
it's
the world.
It's certainly the limits of your agency.
Right.
There's not much else you could have done.
Yes.
Well, Beth, we're going to thank you. This has been really great. Thanks for your conundrum.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
In the spirit of inclusivity, let's check in with an All Lives Matter rally here in New York.